Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Robert J. Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator for today's program. I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Jill Abramson. Since 1997, she's been at the New York Times, and just over a year ago, she became the executive editor. She's the highest-ranking person in the newsroom, managing the news on all print and digital platforms, and she is the paper's first woman to have the title in the paper's 160-year history. Though the Times is nicknamed the Old Gray Lady, it is no small thing that a lady is now at the helm. Ms. Abramson is the consummate New Yorker growing up on Manhattan's Central Park West, where at her house, she says, the New York Times was our religion, and getting this job was like ascending to Valhalla. Breaking down barriers began as a teenager, as she was one of the first female students to live on the Harvard Yard side of campus instead of at Radcliffe. There she studied history, wrote profiles for a student paper, and dabbled in theater. After graduating, her journalism skills evolved while working on campaigns, political campaigns, writing ad copy, doing research, and editing for legal magazines. That led to her first book collaboration, tracing the professional challenges faced by the women of the Harvard class of 1974. In 1988, she became an investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal and rose to Washington's deputy bureau chief. Another book collaboration involved delving into the controversial confirmation hearings of Justice Clarence Thomas. She did that book with another fantastic journalist, Jane Mayer. She made the leap to the New York Times in 1997 to their Washington Bureau and became the Washington Bureau Chief in 2000, and in 2003 became Managing Editor. She's managed through thick and thin. She's been involved in some of the most historic and controversial stories of the last 15 years in Washington and elsewhere, and she's known for taking on very difficult problems. She was in Washington 21 years as a journalist, dealing with power and some of the most powerful interests in the world. And now she's undoubtedly one of the most powerful people in the world, running a global brand that, at the same time, it's one of the great global brands for news and information, and sometimes is the subject of news, is really going through a challenging time, as is all media, as all the revolutionary changes wrought by technology are impacting all of us and how we use and disseminate and get information and create it. So I'm hopeful this will be a very interesting conversation. And first question I had for Jill is...
Rosie, first I have to correct just one small thing. It isn't the Old Gray Lady. It's just the Gray Lady.
Okay. That's on the record. I stand corrected or said corrected. So, Jill, one thing I read about you, and I just wanted to see if it was true, because I'd love to hear the backstory, is that one of the things I read that is when you were coming back to New York after being in Washington, you got a tattoo.
Yes.
Where,
I'm not
why,
showing
what?
It. No, no, the answer is no.
You won't show us, but what, can you talk about why you decided to do that? It was very symbolic about New York.
I did, and I, you know, as I do with many aspects of work and life, I overthought this to death. I decided I wanted to be tattooed with something emblematic of New York, and it was kind of clearly too sappy and maybe even a little dangerous given the state of the journalism profession to have the Times Classic T tattooed on my arm. So that was the first thing I thought of. And then what I decided to do is get a tattoo of the old subway token in New York, because it basically has my philosophy of life printed around the edge after the classic Y that's carved out, which is good for one fare. So that's what I did, and that's the tattoo that I got.
Well, you're having quite a ride with that one fare. I just want to give some context to your career also, but I think it's important that people understand that journalists really have an arc and they're driven by passion. But can you tell a story about your first byline and how you got to that story and what it meant to you?
The first byline after college.
Whatever you choose.
I guess the first, a very early one that I had was I was working for Steve Brill, who became a kind of big figure in covering law and publishing magazines, including The American Lawyer, and he started Court TV. When he started The American Lawyer magazine, I did a piece alone, so it was the first really long, in-depth piece that had my name on it. It was about a lawyer who had gone to Columbia and Harvard Law School, had worked at a law firm in New York, and wound up, believe it or not, as a homeless person sleeping in Central Park. And I worked really hard on that. I was able to establish a relationship with him. And I just remember when the Finnish magazine dropped into my eager hands. I remember it like it was yesterday.
It's really don't lose. Take us through your day. What does the editor of the New York Times do? I mean, I don't know how many stories are done every day. What do you look at? What's your day like?
It's, in some ways there's a routine to it. I usually, get up around 6, and at that point I just start voraciously reading anything in the Times report that I haven't seen the previous day or night. Most of the stories for the, front page of the newspaper go up online, usually by around between 9 and 10. They're usually all up, and I probably have read many of them in the office even before they go up online. But so I start reading like crazy. I read also to see what the competition has. The Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. During the election cycle, I certainly was as addicted to Politico and obviously in the Times report to Nate Silver, as I'm sure all of you were. So I spend about 2 hours reading, and often, have just in the background as background noise Morning Joe on, just to kind of sort of get the daily zeitgeist of what is being talked about, especially in the domestic political realm. I call in to the Times around 7. I check in with our day editor, gets there about then to begin refreshing the website. I usually touch base with the foreign desk to see, because obviously because of the time difference, news can develop in the middle of the night. And I usually don't get to work till 9 or 9:30. And then our first big news meeting is at 10, and that's in what has always been called the Page One Room. It's kind of a storied place with a huge table and sometimes outside visitors, where like all of the major editors of the various sections of the news get together and talk about what they think their big breaking news is for the day, and start beginning to talk about enterprise stories that they hope will be picked for one of the 6 stories on the front page. And that's the morning, and then I have lots of meetings. I try to make sure the day includes enough actual journalism and talking to reporters about something that they're working on. But in the middle of this very thrilling but challenging transition from a print world to a digital world, I'm happy to, be involved in the team of people at the Times who I think so far are smartly navigating that that.
So how does it happen during the day? Because in the old days, you'd have your page one meeting, and at the end of the day,
right.
you went on the front page, and the paper would close, say, at 10 o'clock, mm-hmm. the early edition. It's evolving constantly. Who signs off if there's something? Who changes the front page on the digital and throughout the day? Do you get involved in that? Do you read?
When I was managing editor, I had that job for 8 years, who was called by the night editor, if they were going to change the front page or if some big news developed that would obviously be on the front page, but increasingly involved, like, play on the home page, too. And when we send out a news alert, I'm sure many of you get our news alerts. And as executive editor, I have a great managing editor, Dean Baquet, who I know some of you know from when he was editor of the LA Times. He's a superb journalist, and like you and me, he's wired to love in-depth, investigative, enterprise reporting. He's the one who gets most of those calls now. If it's something really major, I'll get on the phone with him and others too. Well, I don't go to what was the classic the 4:30 front page meeting, which was famous for, the executive editor, like, practically making the other editors pass orals to get their story onto the front page, just firing questions to make the story stronger. But because I'm trying to really focus on our news report on all platforms, I actually very rarely go to that meeting.
One of the most challenging things for any news organization is when it becomes part of the news and how you cover that.
Right.
The Times historically has done that well, even in very difficult situations. And right now with your new CEO.
Who's here? Mark Thompson.
If somebody familiar, it was the former general director of the BBC, and there was a issue there, a scandal, you can call it a controversy, around a program that was not aired related to one of their key star shows. So how have you managed that? It's complicated. I know I believe the editorial page does not report to you. Is that true?
No, that's right. So the columnists who have written about this,
they're separate.
I don't interact with them.
And the ombudsman does not. Does she report to you?
She reports actually to Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher.
So can you explain the process, if you can, a little bit of how, as the editor, you channel that tricky shoal, and also when you have the opinion side of the paper weighing in?
The opinion side of the paper weighs in on so many things that we're covering. That's just kind of life as usual. I'm very close to Andy Rosenthal, who is the head of the opinion pages of the Times. But we don't usually, he consult about how I'm covering something, and if he's going to weigh in with an editorial, he doesn't give me a heads up. There's a Chinese wall, but an important one, between news and opinion at the Times, and there always has been. And in terms of that, and I know you had the pleasure of working at the Times when Abe Rosenthal was the top editor, and he always said that what he wanted to have on his tombstone was simply, he kept the paper straight. And I think about that a lot, because in terms of you're mapping out something that, does require me to wear various hats. But I think my first obligation is that same one, keep the paper straight. And so in covering the BBC scandal, I picked one of our most experienced investigative reporters, Matt Purdy, and any of you who've been following that coverage, I think, know we've been very aggressively following the story. Judiciously, we don't cover every little development in it, but we've had several stories on the front page. And at the same time that story was heating up, Mark Thompson joined the Times as our new CEO, and I was at the time and continue to be extremely excited. I think the Times is really lucky to have him because he has many really interesting, original ideas about how we push forward in this digital transition, and he seems every bit as determined as I am to keep the Times vibrant and alive and completely, although he comes from England, he sees the Times as an irreplaceable institution in American and really global society now. So, you know, what I've done is supervised coverage of the story, trying to get to know Mark better so I can, you know, keep the newsroom at the forefront of any changes that we're making. And, you know, it isn't really that awkward. The person for whom it's perhaps more awkward is Arthur, who's the publisher. And from the days of being managing editor, I've always had an agreement with him of no surprises. So any story that we have of consequence and any story that's the Times is going to play a big role in, I give him a heads up. He has occasionally wanted to see a piece, which he's my publisher, I have no problem with, and he's never asked me to change a word, ever, and is the person who really upholds that, you know, standard of quality and honesty that's a bedrock of the Times. But that's how we've done it. And, you know, in terms of when I give him a heads up, I do it, you know, it's fairly frequently. When we broke the stories that eventually brought down Governor Spitzer, remember his problem? I actually called Arthur on a Saturday night to tell him, you know, we had this story about Elliot Spitzer and it involved hookers and a club for like rich guys and, you know, sort of upscale hookers. And, you know, he listened and he had a couple of questions and he hung up and then he called me back early Sunday morning. I'm positive, just to say, can we go over that again? And I actually think that Arthur thought on Saturday night I might be drunk. So that's why he was calling me Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't think that was a Time story, but that was a great one.
It was the Emperor's Club.
Right. So just... I've run a big newsroom, and one of the dynamics of keeping your newsroom in line also is the trust factor. And I think having a public editor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted the public editor at the Times, her job right now is you hold to account really the paper in terms of fairness and the issues that you care so much about. So just to clarify, she reports to Arthur. So are you aware? What's the process when she's writing about the newsroom?
Usually I am aware, but not always. And I was actually the column that she wrote about the Jimmy Savile matter and Mark. I had no idea that was coming. I'm not implying that she should have told me either. But a lot of the time, the issue is big enough that she'll come to me to talk to me about it.
So when the newsroom sees that, what's the reaction when they come to you? Are they agitated?
They were not agitated with that particular column, but often she's not the first of our public editors. We have had them since 2003. And, usually when the public editor takes aim at a significant piece of journalism that we've published, that tends to create more of a stir.
And this gets to the question of transparency and credibility of the organization, and to be able to criticize yourself in the manner you're hearing, I think, is one of the big assets of the Times.
I totally believe in transparency.
So, shifting subject, this is a question from the audience, I'll paraphrase, mm-hmm. but in the last week or 10 days, you have a new Jerusalem bureau chief who's gotten a little bit of hot water over her tweets.
It was actually Facebook than tweets.
So, I get corrected again by a very good editor. But the issue really is a broader one with the technology, Facebook, Twitter, right, and communications and setting up standards and the issues of instant information and how viral things can go. So how is that handled, and what are your sort of your standards or rules, or does it constantly evolve about in terms of the reporters?
Right. Well, our rules for reporters is that in any public circumstance, whether it's speaking at the Commonwealth Club or tweeting, that we expect and require anyone who works for the Times to adhere to our, you know, basic standards, which include not showing, you know, any, if you're on the news side, you know, not spouting off opinions, not being snarky, having a civil tone, being Timesian in those spaces, which, you know, we've done successfully for years and years. I think over 400 of the reporters and editors in the newsroom, which is about 1,200 people, are on Twitter and actively on more, even more on Facebook. And obviously we don't have enough editors, and I really don't feel the need to, you know, feel like we have to monitor in real time everything that people tweet about. And I think that social media has played an important role both in, you know, helping us cover the news, especially out on the campaign trail this year. I mean, every reporter had, you know, their tweet deck up. That's where news breaks now on the campaign, and that it's been good for expanding the reach of the Times News Report. So I think it's by and large been healthy, and we've had very few instances where it's created any concern. But when you're the Jerusalem bureau chief, I mean, the Mideast story for the Times has always been, you know, something that every word is watched. And for the whole time I've been at the Times, both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinian side, have been certain that we're biased against their side. And I certainly, over the years, have gotten more incoming response from the public about our coverage, particularly pictures, sometimes video. And in that case, Jody Rudoran, who's the new bureau chief, was on social media. And it's not that, you know, she wrote anything that was, you know, showed lack of objectivity or insensitivity or whatever, but she used a couple of words that were criticized, and I think rightfully so. She thinks rightfully so, and I think just on that beat where every single word is scrutinized, we're going to have an editor on the foreign desk who actually is in charge of social media for the foreign desk, like, just give a glance.
So one of the things Jill's also describing is, you know, the new evolution of a newsroom. 3 years ago, probably you weren't thinking of having a social media editor on the foreign desk. But one of the challenges, I think, and is how do you begin to monetize it? I mean, you talk about the strategy of social and reaching new audiences. I think this week you had to announce a very small number of jobs being eliminated in the newsroom. How do you envision, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons you're at it, this question of sustainability. How does an incredibly important institution like the New York Times, how do you look ahead to the next 3 to 5 to 10 years? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're thinking about this. Bring in the revenue when you see what's happening with advertising versus print versus the, you know, digital.
I mean, Mark, would you like to handle this question?
This is a question.
No, I know.
No, I'm just kidding. But it's really a crucial issue really for democracy in this country.
It is, and you know, the bedrock principle of the New York Times is what we sell is quality journalism, and yeah, to let that quality diminish in any perceptible way would be a huge mistake. As we push the Times out on more platforms than ever, just adhering to that, like, times and quality, which involves very thorough reporting, which involves keeping a very robust number of foreign correspondents. We're the only national newspaper right now that has a sizable number of domestic bureaus. The Washington Post, which used to have a national staff, has had to close up their national reporters in cities like this one, and that's not going to happen at the Times. We had a staff reduction in 2008 as well. About 100 positions were knocked out then, and we still have the same number of domestic and foreign and metro and business and reporters and culture and our feature sections than we've ever had. There's been no diminishment. We've moved some foreign bureaus from one place to another because of the demands of news in particular areas. But news gathering is what we do, and having enough editors to intelligently distill and present that wonderful work is crucial too. So far, you know, we have had, it's painful to have any cuts in the newsroom. You've been through it much worse, than I have. But you try to do it strategically and judiciously, keeping in mind that you've got to keep the print newspaper and our news report as vibrant and robust as ever, but push ahead into all new platforms, because we want people to read the Times and watch the Times and have access to it in any way, anywhere that they're reading. But so there are some jobs that over time, you know, I'd love to keep them all, that, you know, become a little bit less central to that mission, which is keep the news report as glorious as ever it has been, but keep pushing really hard on the digital front.
So when you look ahead, because you're, you know, the content, you know, it's no longer simply in the paper, obviously, but where do you see potential biggest growth for audience in your platforms, as well as potentially the revenue, whether it's video, you know, data? I mean, if you're a publisher and say, right, I'll give you 30 positions, Jill, but let's really use them to grow our audience and generate revenue off the content, what would you do?
Well, one thing the Times has done, I think, very smartly in terms of revenue is that we boldly moved to a paid digital subscription model, you know, 2 years ago now. And that has developed. The newspaper always was supported by two major streams of revenue, advertising and circulation. And for those of you who are among the 850,000 people who have had home delivery subscriptions for 2 years or more, thank you, because we consider, if someone has had home delivery of the Times for 2 years or more, we consider them hopelessly hooked. There isn't the kind of churn that other newspapers have had to deal with. And, you know, the digital subscription plan has brought in a nice stream of revenue, and it's one that we very much intend, and Mark intends to, and Arthur too, for us to grow, and that's been a success. I can tell you calmly that it's enough revenue to offset, you know, what would have been very troubling steep declines in especially print advertising. What we're trying to do is have that same nice revenue balance between, you know, addicted subscribers, and because of the premium nature of our news, we're hoping that advertising digitally will eventually catch up to that too. That it's worth it to, you know, pay a premium because you're in this glorious environment of the best news report, I think, in the world.
So, and how much of your audience is global, outside the U.S.? I mean, is it increasing? How do you monetize that?
It's increased, and a third of our digital audience comes to us from outside of the country. And, you know, how do we monetize it? We have some overseas segments of our audience who are among the people, you know, signing up to have a digital subscription. It isn't as nicely tied, obviously, to home delivery mm-hmm. of the Times as it is here, but it's forced us. We always have had, you know, a very robust foreign report. We've always covered global business, but, you know, it's forced us, which I think is a good thing, to have more of a global orientation and to, you know, have even broader ambitions for the stories that we cover.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to distill all these questions.
Sure.
Let's go back when you, I believe you were Washington Bureau Chief, and several of the questions are about this in the run-up, and these are about difficult decision-making
WMD.
And your authority mm-hmm. and the power of the New York Times, mm-hmm. and the build-up to Gulf War II, or the invasion of Iraq. The Times, obviously, and the media in general in Washington were widely criticized for not revealing certain things.
The Times in particular.
Right. And you were in the middle of that. What insights did you learn from that? Are there things you would have done differently now? You were the Washington Bureau Chief. And if you can just go through that period and sort of what you've gleaned over the
years. Of course there are things I would do differently. And I actually, you know, have thought about that time recently because, you know, I've thought deeply about the BBC story and, you know, how Mark has explained his role at the BBC. And if there's any one thing I could change, it would be, as Washington Bureau Chief, not all of the reporters who were covering WMD issues and Iraq were part of the Washington Bureau. And I just wish, you know, many of those stories didn't come through me, but certainly I was aware of them, you know, and I wish I had been paying more attention because the Times really did brandish on the front page some very questionable stories that were based on, you know, Iraqi defectors who had an interest in promoting the toppling of Saddam Hussein, who were going around to various reporters, including reporters at the Times, peddling, you know, the story of this ramped up WMD program, which of course didn't exist. So that is number one. I wish I had paid more attention. And journalism isn't a game that you play with 20/20 hindsight vision, unfortunately. I'm sure, you know, that many people at the BBC wish, you know, gee, I wish I had been, you know, paying more attention to the documentary and whatnot. So, number one, I wish I was paying more attention to the totality of the coverage. And some of the stories that were faulty, including the one about the tubes that suggested, you know, when the Times published that story on the front page, and you know, it was kind of a welcome sign for Dick Cheney and Condi Rice to go on the Sunday shows to talk about mushroom clouds that, of course, were a fantasy. And there, I think, and I've done a lot of thinking about this, I wish that I had been more tuned in to the reporters in Washington, a few in the Times' bureau, but especially Knight Ritter, which had at the time a very, very good Washington bureau. And their major sources on this were skeptics within the CIA analysts who were like, be careful with this WMD evidence. They were very skeptical about it. And, you know, some of our intelligence reporters did those stories too, but they tended to be played on page A10 instead of the front page where all the scary stories about biochemical and even nuclear weapons vis-a-vis Iraq were played. And when our first public editor wrote about this, it was Dan Okrent. He had a great line. He said, you know, the bad stories were played as lead of the paper, and the right ones were played as quiet as lullabies. And that's true, and I wish I could change that.
Just want to explain a little bit, because the dynamic between being the Washington bureau chief and the what you were just describing, really, the inability to maybe manage, even though you're in charge in Washington, the dynamic between New York and Washington, and how that's, having had that job, how maybe that's affected your handling that now as the editor.
It has, and it's made me listen very closely when the bureau chief now, David Leonhardt, feels we're either overplaying or underplaying a story. He is closer to what's happening, so to listen and not be so quick to want to put wind in the sails of stories which may be more complicated than the editors in New York see it. They're like, we're scoop hungry. I've been guilty of that myself. We have a great scoop leading the paper today, but you have to make sure that hunger for the New York Times is reporting. You know, I love waking up to that. I'll admit it, but you have to make sure that doesn't make you over enthusiastic about when you run stories and how you play them.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Jill Abramson, executive editor of the New York Times. Excuse me. Jill, you've been the editor now a little over a year, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So you were very close to the power of the throne, in a sense, as one of the managers.
Yeah, I worked for Bill Keller.
Right. So now, but there's a real difference to be handed the keys to this, the closet.
I always say it's the key, not to the closet, to the keys to the Ferrari, please.
Yeah, I'm always wondering what was behind the closet, but the Ferrari Rolls Royce. But what has surprised you? What has become something you never thought you'd have to deal with once you have the keys to that Ferrari?
Yeah, the things that surprise me are always usually, that, and I wouldn't, this was a surprise, I think, when I became managing editor, and I don't know if it has to do with the fact that I'm a woman, but people somehow feel reporters and editors feel comfortable coming to me to talk out their troubles. And journalism, and I think you'll agree, Rosie, that especially investigative journalism can be a kind of manic depressive cycle. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And, the things that people will come in to talk to me about just always surprise me. And the one thing I didn't study in college was psychology. And it's the one thing I wish I had studied, because nothing I studied is useful in this job at all.
It's true. Very true. So here's a question I'm sure you've been asked a lot, but where do you see, the print versus the weight of your distribution or your audience, say, in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years, in terms of the newspaper versus digital?
I don't see it as the newspaper versus digital. I think we're going to have the print newspaper is beloved. It's lively. I think that certainly, for the rest of my career, which I hope is a long one, although I don't intend to rename it the Old Gray Lady. The newspaper is going to be around. It's like an incredibly wonderful, serendipitous way to read the news. You all know that. My pal and colleague Maureen Dowd used to say, it's the best time you can have for a dollar. It's, $2.50 now, sorry, but just having quiet time to page through the paper is to me the best time you can have. But it's in digital, not versus the web. And it's basically having one newsroom and one news report that feeds and nourishes everything. The paper and every other platform. It's one news report, and that's, as managing editor, that's what I worked on the hardest, and that work isn't completed, but I'm going to kill myself to get there.
So how are you integrating the platforms? So, can you go through an example of the story that you think was a success where you had the video, maybe it was podcast audio?
Yeah, sure. One that just popped into my mind, and there are so many, is Dan Barry, who's a fantastic writer, has been at the Times a long time, did a series of stories one of the weeks before the election about Elyria, Ohio. And, it was tied to the election, but never expressly so. And it was going to a kind of dying Rust Belt town and meeting the characters who were kind of the bedrock people of that town and who usually gathered in the morning at a diner. And so Dan wrote five long and I thought fabulous and compelling print stories about Elyria. But we had like a multimedia presentation of that story, which was thrilling to me. The video wasn't repeating what the story said. It was a whole new way to organically read the stories while actually being able to see and hear the people who you came to care about so much reading the story. There were interactive graphics about the economy of Ohio. It's a rich package, and we do that now with more frequency. It's a kind of narrative story, multimedia storytelling that I am blown away by. And I think, like, back to the days when it was just I spent 10 years at the Wall Street Journal, a newspaper that at that time didn't even have photographs, just dot drawings. And of course, as an investigative reporter, the people I was writing about, never had a dot drawing because they were in hiding, because they were all involved in scandals. But I think that we have a whole new audience. Younger readers seem to totally respond to these integrated multimedia projects that we do. And we did it with WikiLeaks. We've done it. We do it frequently. It's like a push of the whole newsroom where you have a team and everybody from interactive news, social media, video, photography, and, the editors and the reporters all get together and kind of make a show. It's just fantastic.
How would you slice your audience in terms of age demographics? Is it skewed higher over 55, how do you keep track of all that?
People are always surprised to hear that, like, the average age of Times readers has gone up, but not to anything near 55.
And are they shifting? Are they going using the paywall? Or are they still in print?
The most cherished part of our audience is probably you're my peeps, right? Are people who get home delivery because they love the paper, but they want that, like, up to the minute 24/7 news report of the web. So they want our website, and when they're traveling or when they're in bed, I know I'm guilty of taking the iPad to bed. They want it everywhere, and they're, because they, are checking in on our homepage many times a day, reading maybe some of the great feature stories that they didn't have time for in the morning later on. They want it every way, and that's what we do. We give it to them anywhere they want to engage with our content, they can.
Do you have rules now with them? Once a story is ready to go, is it, do you hold it for the paper? Or
no,
is it just as soon as it's ready
never.
To go, it's gone?
And really, you know, I would say the turning point in that evolution was the NSA eavesdropping story that we did, that the Bush administration had said the Times couldn't, and then after it was published said we shouldn't publish about the NSA eavesdropping on conversations between people in the U.S. and overseas without getting a court warrant, which was illegal at the time. They since amended the law. But with that story, Bill Keller, who was executive editor, and I consulted, and we decided we publish stories when they're ready. And so we actually published that web first. You know, it was like probably the biggest scoop that we had, you know, in that time period, and you know, it got all the attention. I mean, you used to worry if we put on the web, others like the Washington Post are going to steal our story and not give us credit. That isn't the case, and we try hard to credit other people's stories too. But Bill's mantra has become my mantra, which is we publish stories when they're ready, period.
One of the things that's often overlooked when people think about journalists is that they literally risk their lives to go out and cover very difficult situations. You know, this also gets to having the Ferrari key. You've had, I think, Anthony passed away under your watch.
Oh, yeah.
Another one of your photographers lost two legs. I'm not sure it happened.
Zhao Silva, yeah.
So you're literally sending people into situations where they can be killed.
Right.
Ferrari holder. I mean, that is a big responsibility. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, my heart is in, when I know that we have a reporter in Syria now, my heart is in my throat. But to fulfill the mandate of covering the world in the way our readers expect us to, it's impossible to say, you know, if it was literally so dangerous that there were no prudent ways to go in and cover things, you know, I'm not crazy. I wouldn't do it. I have not encountered a situation yet where, you know, we've had to completely pull reporters out.
So is your reporter now in Damascus or traveling?
No, we don't have anyone in Damascus.
Staffer.
We have some, you know, stringers who wouldn't want me to disclose who they are. And people go in selectively, and they go in, have to know about it. Even when Nick Kristof, who, you know, doesn't work for me, was going in, because we have a very elaborate security protocol, and, you know, so far we've had security people go in since Anthony's death, which I feel, you know, was an incredible tragedy and loss to readers not only of the Times but everywhere. It was very painful. When he was killed, he wasn't killed. That's what I was going to remind everybody of, that, you know, he had an asthmatic condition from when he was young, and he and Tyler Hicks, who is a photographer who was with him, walked behind horses as they were getting out. They had a completely safe trip in Syria, and Anthony was so excited about the reporting he did and the stories that he wanted to write. But coming out, crossing the border into Turkey, walking behind horses, he was particularly allergic to horses, and he had this terrible asthma attack and, you know, died on the spot, which is, you know, about the most awful thing that can happen under any editor's watch, for sure. But, you know, the Times is such an important lens through which people can gain understanding of what's going on in the world and what it means, that you can't make something like that. I mean, David Rode was kidnapped in Afghanistan when I was managing editor. There are, you know, terrible things, and I don't mean to say the Times is in a special place and having had, you know, terrible things happen to our reporters. It's a very dangerous profession, and right now there are many countries where journalists have been killed. The Committee to Protect Journalists keeps a census of them, and the numbers are horrifying. But, you know, I have to be honest and say when someone's there, and certainly after Anthony died, it's like when I hear we're sending someone into a really dangerous spot, my heart is in my throat. And, you know, sort of like a nagging mother, what I try to do is, like, if a reporter is asking for a 6-day trip into Syria, I'm like, make that 4. You know, I just try around the edges to the extent I can reduce the danger, because it's a horrible, you know, and I don't feel it. It's a terrible thing to have to live with when your heart is in your throat. And I'm not in a special position there. I mean, our photo editor, our foreign editor, the editors that work under him, colleagues of the reporters are also waiting with bated breath to hear that someone has crossed back safely. And, you know, it's definitely, yes, part of having the keys to the Ferrari, but you do it in a balanced way, and you make sure you have the best security people. I mean, we have maintained, you know, bureaus in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, you know, cost millions of dollars because of security to maintain.
Could you quickly explain what you do in Kabul? I mean, have the security you set up.
Yeah, I actually, after I was named to this job, Dean Baquet and I went to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and we stayed for a week and lived in a bureau in Kabul where our correspondents and sometimes a videographer, usually a photographer, they live and work there. We have Afghani staff who work there. It's a fairly involved operation. It's a big house. We have a full-time security person who's fantastic, who lives in the house with them. And day by day, he gives guidance on whether, you know, someone who wants to go out and report a story, whether the route is safe and whether it's advisable or inadvisable that they go. And that's just part of doing business in a prudent way there. But, you know, it's unnerving. When we were, you know, in Pakistan, we had, you know, members of the ISI followed us everywhere that we went. And it's, you know, it's you know, creepy. And you know, I only had to do it, and, you know, Dean Baquet and I, for a week. But having to go through such a rigmarole just to, like, talk to people and do honest reporting is awful. But, you know, I'm in, you know, both awe and overwhelmed with gratitude. We have Alyssa Rubin has been in Kabul for years and years now, you know, who stay because they feel a passion to tell the story. I mean, Alyssa just had an amazing story last Saturday on honor killings in Afghanistan, where this 16-year-old girl was horribly beaten and almost killed by her brother because she had run away with a guy who was, you know, he was killed, we assume, by the brother. But she took me to a women's shelter in Kabul, which is one, you know, an amazing experience. There were, you know, obviously most of the women there were covered. And it took me about 10 minutes to realize how young many of them were. It was a shelter for mothers and their children. And, you know, I would say the average age of the women I was talking to was, I asked them, how old are you? 15, 16, 17. You know, most of them were, you know, just heartbreakingly young. And they have the same aspirations as any girls that age do, to be doctors or, you know, we talked about, or, you know, teachers. And Alyssa has been, you know, a main way that the story of these women has been kept alive over the years. And she feels a tremendous commitment to that, as do I.
Running the New York Times in some ways is almost like having your own branch of the State Department. It's true. But so right now, one of the issues, obviously, and it was illuminated to everybody, you know, a few weeks ago when the Israelis and Palestinians were, you know, going at it. The images out of Gaza, everybody was there. And then you have Syria. It's almost impossible. You get the grainy video that the activists put out.
CNN actually had fantastic video this morning as I was getting ready in Damascus. And they've had pretty good stuff in Aleppo, too.
So what? Now you have the chemical weapons issue. How, with your history and the Times history, how do you go about really verifying?
Carefully. Very carefully.
So do you do that from Washington? Are you thinking about how you do it on the ground? Do you trace
both.
Sales?
Both. I mean, mainly it's trying to assess both domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence on what's being moved where and what is it. But you haven't seen, you know, a banner headline like sarin gas, and you know, not that the Times would ever have done that, but we, because of the history that you cite, we're very careful and we're aggressively reporting that story, and we'll see. You know, nobody knows at this point exactly what's being weaponized.
So as the editor, do you come in or think, you know, I really want to focus on X, Y, or Z? How do we do this better? Is there an area now, without being critical of the paper, or where you think right now are some of the key issues for the Times in the weeks, months ahead, both globally and domestic?
Well, obviously, you know, and I think the fiscal cliff has been somewhat hyped, and I'm, you know, very thankful that I don't think our coverage has. It's been, you know, thorough. It's on the front page today. That's a huge story. I mean, the euro crisis could, it's quieted down a bit, but that could flare up at any point. You know, China is always like a key story, and because we broke, David Barbosa did his two investigative pieces about the Princeling culture in China. We have a new Chinese language website, and unfortunately that was shut down.
Is that still shut down?
It's still shut down. Actually, Bloomberg did a story of its own which suggested corruption by the family of one of the political leaders, and they've been shut down as well, and shut down longer than we have, but still
so
shut down.
Is that in Mandarin? Is the website in Mandarin? Or,
yeah.
And what was your audience before it gets shut down?
It was growing. Our audience were, you know, intelligent people in China, thirsty for quality news, who, you know, were, I think, very welcoming of the Times quality news report.
So were you translating the entire report or selectively?
We had Chinese reporters covering stories in China that didn't necessarily appear in the Times. And it was growing, and we're hopeful that it will be up and running again sometime soon.
So you had a zone digital edition for China, basically?
In its own, I guess. So I'm not sure it's a perfect analogy, but also translated New York Times stories, too, including, I'm proud to say, David Barbosa's long investigative piece, which went up for maybe a couple seconds.
So it's been shut since then?
Yeah.
It's weeks now.
It's weeks now.
So how do you negotiate that getting reopened, or can you, or do you try?
No, I mean, it wouldn't be my job to negotiate that, because obviously it's the Chinese government and would be the place of Mark or Arthur, their colleagues, to be most involved in that.
But are you translating it to others? Targeted
We're thinking about it. They're definitely thinking about it.
What do you have competition, and who is it, and how do you define your competition?
Well, the answer is yes, and you know, it's sort of everywhere during the election. You know, it was Politico, it was BuzzFeed, it was like an array of, it was, you know, definitely still the Washington Post, you know, the TV networks and CNN to some degree too, and you know, being on top of all of that is, you know, a job and a half for anyone. But you know, I think in the breadth of what we cover and the richness of the Times news report, yes, we have competitors, but I don't think any who play in all of the areas that we're in.
Who are the leaders in that you've admired the most, that you sort of learn from or can learn from or continue to learn from, both in and outside journalism?
Okay, inside journalism, I'll quickly cite two, and purposely not from the Times, because, you know, I could bend your ears on and on, but it would be somewhat self-serving to do so. Actually, amazingly, my first paying job in journalism was at Time Magazine in their Boston Bureau, and it was in 1976 during, you know, a different presidential election cycle. I was lowest person on the totem pole, but Time had a woman bureau chief in Boston. She was the only woman bureau chief. She had, of course, started working at Time as Henry Grunwald's secretary. She'd been hired as a secretary. Then, after years and years, she became a researcher, finally a correspondent, and being, you know, named a bureau chief was a big deal. And she showed, and even though I was like right out of college, she just showed such interest in me, and she actually, though it wasn't part of my job, gave me reporting assignments and sent me up to New Hampshire the night of the New Hampshire primary, where I was like gazing starry-eyed at Hunter Thompson and, you know, other, you know, legendary political correspondents. And she just, you know, I encouraged me so much. And because she was my first boss, I kind of proceeded in the profession under the assumption that, like, a woman could just, like, really be, you know, killer successful in it. And, you know, I maintained a relationship with her. Her name was Sandy Burton. Unfortunately, she passed away. She's working in Hong Kong. And when I became Washington Bureau Chief, I was the first woman to hold that job, she sent me a telegram that simply said, "I can hear the glass shattering to Hong Kong." So I'll stop there.
Now you are the leader, you have the keys. What is it, something you've become aware of that's really a crucial asset that you have, or something you want to make sure people realize that you have, or maybe you don't want them to realize you have?
Well, I think, you know, from Sandy, I definitely, you know, I try to know everyone in the newsroom and kind of always have my eye out for, you know, young people in the newsroom who, you know, I should be paying attention to and encouraging in the way she encouraged me. But I think, you know, a key skill for any leader is listening. Like, talking less and listening has been a discipline that's been a little hard for me to acquire over the years. I'm still working on it.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question. So I want to talk to you, if you're looking to the future and you're hiring, and what are the key skills? And I'm optimistic about the future of journalism, not pessimistic, and I'm sure you are optimistic. But what are the key skills that you want to see in the journalists of the future that bridge but the values of the past but also go to the mm-hmm. future?
I mean, what I look for when I'm interviewing someone, it's always been true, I look for someone who's like passionate about a good story. And, you know, sure, we tell those stories in different ways now, but that's the key thing. And I always try to ask questions and listen closely to see, does that person have that passion?
Yes, it is passion driven. We want to thank our guest, Jill Abramson, executive editor of the New York Times, for visiting with us from San Francisco.
Thank you.
This was a rare treat, and we hope you come back soon. And please extend our invitation to your legion of talented reporters when they come through our city.
Some of whom
Bay.
Are here. Felicity Barringer is here, and Quentin Hardy, I think, is here.
We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Robert J. Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.